We were there at the dawn of the third age of mankind, in the Earth year 2257, deep in neutral space. We were there when the last of the Babylon stations was founded. The name of the pod is Babylon 5.
Midnight on the firing line, in which a Narn sneak attack on a Centauri outpost brings the powers to the brink of war, and Earth elects a new president. Also, we meet the new station telepath, Talia Winters, and the new first officer, Lieutenant Commander Susan Ivanova. Let us never speak of Laurel Takashima again. And there's some nonsense about space pirates.
Welcome to episode 2 of The Name of the Pod, the podcast where we take a look at the ongoing legacy and influence of the television show Babylon 5. I'm your co-host, Chris Tatro.
And I'm your co-host, John Cassie.
And today we're looking at Season 1, Episode 1, Midnight on the Firing Line. And the topics we're going to be exploring today are the introduction of Lieutenant Commander Susan Ivanova, the politics of Earth and the Earth Alliance, such as they are, and the Centauri-Narn conflict, which I think is going to be central to the show in the seasons as we continue on. In the background, that's our third co-host, my cat Geppetto, who has found a box on the table.
A box. It's Babylon 3.
Clearly. Yes.
Right. Yeah. This is the reason why Babylon 3 was, never made it. Right. A cardboard space station. I mean, there's just no way.
Babylon 4 was knocked down the stairs and underneath the couch, never to be seen again.
That's right. So, and Babylon 6... We're not going to speak about Babylon 6.
We never talk about Babylon 6.
Yeah, that's an entirely different matter.
So, Midnight on the Firing Line, a really solid episode, I think, and a good place to start off season one. As far as pilot episodes go, I wouldn't put it up there with the pilot to Lost or Deep Space Nine, which I think stand in at the pinnacle for me.
Right.
Agreed. But this was a really, really a good place. Maybe even, I'm going to go ahead and say, stronger than The Gathering. If we'd started here, I think we'd have been just fine.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I mean, The Gathering, as you listeners would know from our previous episode, we both were quite fond of. And I was more fond of it having watched it again, just now than I was when it had originally come out. But this episode was sort of... It was a great surprise to me how tight it was.
Yeah.
I didn't remember it being quite as on message, and quite as tight as it turned out to be. So I think it's a dynamite episode. Great place to start the show.
It doesn't have a lot of the rambling and it doesn't have enough time to meander. It's trying to do a lot of work in a 42-minute episode. And I think it, for the most part, nails its goals.
Right. Nearly everything that we want that we need to learn, in this episode, we learn in a very clear, tight, and kind of effective way.
Mm-hmm. Let's start off with one of the biggest, I think, benefits or improvements here compared to The Gathering, and that's Susan Ivanova.
Yeah.
Who I think is a phenomenal character, and I think Claudia Christian is a great actor in bringing her to life.
Totally. Totally.
We get her, in one short sentence, I get who this character is, and that's I'm in the middle of 15 things, all of them annoying.
Right.
That's delivered in a staccato, she doesn't have time for this,
Right. Right. She's got very serious hair, right?
Yep.
She stands purposefully, in front of that control window, in front of her panel, right? It's clearly, that's her operations center.
Yep. Right. Don't touch my panels. What are you doing touching my panels?
Right. Stop touching my panels, right?
Do I have to, do I have to take your hands off at the wrist or whatever she says to Garibaldi?
Right.
yeah.
Chris, one of the things that you raised in The Gathering was, look, this show isn't working for me yet because the humans are so samey.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever note JMS had to take, in order to kind of get that, I think he heard it because he's found an actress who's got an edge. Claudia Christian is edge, right?
Yes.
And she's been given a character who's got way more complexity, I think, than really any other human.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we've had an hour and a half of Jeffrey Sinclair, and within 10 minutes, Susan Ivanova feels way more developed and complicated. And that undoubtedly is partly Claudia Christian, who I think the fact that she's not presently working, carrying one of these, you know, Netflix sci-fi programs or something like that, you know, put her on Stranger Things, you know, put her on one of those kind of programs and she would be dynamite.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I've been poking around at IMDb looking, and you know, this show seemed to be kind of the kiss of death for a lot of people's careers. It's kind of a tangent note here, but
just the kiss of death for people's lives.
Well, yeah.
God, I mean, bless the body count on this show is high.
Yeah. Yeah. But even the people who are still with us, we don't. You know, right. There's not a lot of, you know, they're working. I mean, they're working and they're certainly doing more than I am. Right. But they're, we don't see a lot of people picking up big roles. Mia Furlong in Lost, I think, is maybe the exception.
Maybe the exception, yeah. I mean, Bruce Boxleitner had a big career beforehand, so he's probably hard to, you know, to put in that.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the people who you'd think, well, maybe they would, go on, have passed, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, Andres Katsoulas has passed, and Jerry Doyle, you know, had a huge political career,
right?
You know, after Babylon 5, and you know, were he still alive, I'm sure he'd be a very kind of consistent and powerful voice for, you know, kind of the what I might call the Trump movement. You know, not trying to get into Earth politics of the year 2017, but you know, Jerry Doyle will certainly cut from that cloth. And while you know, I don't think we have many notes of the Garibaldi character yet. Just like we don't have many notes, I don't think yet of the Sheridan, not the Sheridan character, the Sinclair character.
Mm.
To your point, we're 45 minutes in to knowing Susan Ivanova, and she's just compulsively watchable.
Yeah. And we get information about, you know, her family. We get connections to other people. You know, yes, we had Sinclair's story about the line.
Right.
And didn't – no, I was thinking of something else. But yeah, we get the story of her mother and this very tragic kind of backstory. We've got nothing of that on Garibaldi at this point.
That's right, and we get the new telepath, Talia Winters, who, you know, I'm gonna put a flag on the field right now that I always preferred Talia Winters to Lita Alexander, and you know, that's something that when Talia Winters is opened up a little bit as a character, we can talk more about, but we get Talia Winters in this episode primarily as a foil to stoke Susan Ivanova's kind of righteous anger about the Psi-Cor and what it did to her family. And it's nice to see a little bit of that human-to-human conflict because, again, think about the time frame where we are. This episode debuts in January of 1994. We're only 20-ish issues, episodes into DS9. And we're still right in the kind of imaginative wheelhouse of Star Trek The Next Generation, where this kind of conflict, you know, it's not what Trek feels like. And good on B5 for saying, we're not going to do that. We're going to do this other thing. And that actually becomes one of the main legacies, I think. The kind of character, the way that a Susan Ivanova is written. Is Kara Thrace on Babylon 5? Not Babylon 5, on Battlestar Galactica. And sort of on and on, right?
Yeah. The strengths of Claudia Christian as an actor, you know, the in the speech that, you know, the scene between Ivanova and Talia, where she's explaining what happened to her mother and all of this, that could have been a complete disaster of a scene.
Correct.
That is a Straczynskiist speech, right there.
If ever there was one, right?
But she nails it.
Right.
And that gets her some props.
Right. Because very often, you know, a lesser actor would be done in by some of the kind of hamminess of the dialogue, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, there are times when even Claudia Christian's considerable powers will fail, but we'll get to them, you know, in the fullness of time.
Yeah.
I think she's an extraordinary character, and we get to see a kind of non-blandly Western vision, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, she's still, you know, kind of a European. You know, it's not like she's a Polynesian, right? It's not like she's from, you know, the Free State of Congo or something like that. I mean, that would have been interesting, but that's not what we got.
And it's 1994.
It's 1994, right.
You know, I don't think that there was as much of a push for diversity in your television casts as, you know, as we have today. There wasn't, you know, I don't think that networks were willing to go out on a limb and include people from non
correct
white European backgrounds as much.
Right.
You know, we have one minority on the show. Isn't that enough?
Right.
We look at all the aliens we have. They count. Sure.
Right. Right.
But yeah, you know, so definitely a solid introduction, and really looking forward to more Ivanova as the years go on.
For sure.
Yeah.
Now, when we think about the subtext of this, you know, of this episode, we've got a lot of both Narn, Centauri politics and conflict being unpacked, but also we've got an election on Earth that's being resolved.
Right. Yep.
Now, when it comes to Earth, you know, we talked in the last episode about Space Joe Biden and how it didn't make sense. What is a, you know, is there a Babylon 5 governing select committee?
Well, you know, there is apparently.
There is apparently, right? Yeah. Does that make any sense? I'm going to say, well, no, not to me.
Not right? much.
I mean, I think that something like this is almost certainly, you know, if I were going to be, you know, writing this, then you'd end up with Sinclair as kind of like the ambassador to the UN, right?
Yeah.
Or like a special envoy, or, you know, he'd have both military and diplomat. It doesn't make sense. Why is he taking orders from this person?
Mm. Yeah. And why is there no Earth ambassador? You know,
why is there
the captain,
Earth ambassador, right?
A military officer, presumably, you know, some fleet form of military, you know, since they've got rank, is the one representing Earth. But you'd think that a career politician or diplomat of some note would be the one sitting down at the table with the you know, the Mimbari and the Narn and the Centauri.
That
seems odd, and that we have the Senate, you know, again, is this Earth Senate? Is it United States Senate? Right. Probably Earth Senate.
Right.
You know,
the Earth Senate, right?
Yeah. Is you know, that telling Sinclair how to vote, you know, and saying you've been authorized by the subcommittee to do this and that. There seemed to be a lot of back and forth between the military and the civilian government the pieces just don't click for me.
Right. It remains a point of contention. It remains something to be explained. I look at all of my contemporary examples in real life, and I find no analog that makes sense. I look at sort of fictional analogs, they also don't make any sense, right? You look at Starfleet, and
you've got the distinction there between the Federation and Starfleet. There's two different bodies,
right.
presumably working together, but
you've got a Federation Starfleet Council.
Yeah. But you'd never have Kirk at the table as the Federation ambassador.
No.
They killed my son.
Right. No. So it remains a bone of contention for me, because clearly the show wants to establish itself as kind of courageously taking on and building out a political framework. It's we're in the middle of a presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see the campaign speeches. I want to hear them talk. I want to hear them talk to each other. It's just kind of a cast off, he wants to, he's going to, reduce the budget and, deal with all of these aliens coming to Earth. That's it, really?
Preserve Earth culture.
Right.
Keep us out of wars. We've got to. Well, by the end of the episode, we know that Santiago has won,
right?
And that we have what sounds like a very isolationist administration coming in.
Right.
But
right.
I think it would have been a lot stronger not to have the election in this first episode. Give us a half a season or so of, news coming in from Earth. Here are the things, the campaign speeches, maybe even a visit from.
Right. Exactly.
This is a campaign stop here, some sort of publicity stunt.
Right.
Would have served them well to get to tie in the Earth politics. But it, again, was that kind of stringing a plot along half of a season something that was done in 1994?
Yeah,
Straczynski's already really going out on the limb with this whole 5-year plan.
Right. Yeah, you're completely right about that. And again, to the point about legacy, I think that even though I'm making the case, at least to me, at the time and now, I don't find the politics of the Earth Alliance particularly clear or resonant. He's at least making a go of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in all fairness, it's not like the civilian politics of Star Trek were ever particularly well explained or ever made all that much sense.
Yeah,
you needed to go deep into uncharted novel territory, or comic books or whatever, to get at some of.
Right.
The politics of the Star Trek universe. So, I'm kind of dogging this episode a little bit, but it's not really fair,
And to be fair, to the show, the two of us are the sort who would love nothing more than a 3-hour documentary or a 700-page novel, or manual explaining in painful detail the full operation history and, bureaucratic ins and outs of the Earth government.
Yeah, I'll be very clear on this. There is no number of pages that I wouldn't read.
Yes.
Right. Yep. If it was a 1,000-page book on the politics of the Earth Alliance, I'm in. 2,000 pages, I'm in.
That's it.
Biographies of all of the presidents of the Earth Alliance since the founding of the Earth Alliance, I'm in.
Give me a semester-long class.
Right?
Yes.
But most importantly, if you're only going to spend 3 minutes on an episode on the politics of a thing, those politics must make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I'm still waiting for them to make sense.
Yeah.
And this is, again, to the point about legacy. People making television and movies after this, with the notable exception of George Lucas, whose politics in the prequel movies were even more bewildering, I guess I will say, and leave it at that.
Mm.
Right. You look at the politics of Battlestar Galactica. Well, they pay very careful attention to how that works.
Mm-hmm.
Pay attention to the politics of how The Expanse is written.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Very carefully done. There wouldn't be an appetite for those programs, in my judgment, without Babylon 5 in the first place. So good on them, even though they're not getting over the line for me yet.
Did we have a lot of political dramas in real depth that were on the air by this time? I mean, West Wing is still – that's we're talking late 90s for West Wing, right?
West Wing is one of those shows that I've never really watched.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a kind of millennium crosser, you know, like late 90s, early aughts.
But I'm just thinking that you know, was there an appetite for detailed, you know, politics that makes sense? I mean, Benson, you know, okay, let's not count Benson.
Benson.
But
you know, Carter country, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yep. No. No,
we just don't have anything.
Right. This is me, right? Mm. It's my podcast. I can complain about what I want.
Absolutely.
But now, okay. So leaving aside the Space Joe Biden Earth Alliance problems, I think the episode is at its strongest is in unpacking the ongoing Narn Centauri century long conflict with. You know, the opening of that jump gate within the first 30 seconds of the program and, you know, the streaming out of it of, you know, of a Narn attack fleet against an undefended colony.
Yeah. Yeah. And we don't know right away that it is a Narn fleet.
Oh,
we
don't.
Who it is, but this will become obvious in, you know,
in short order.
You know, yeah. And it's definitely... You know, there's justifications made that this is you took this system from us, so we're just taking it back, but you know, doing it through military force certainly is it's setting a pretty strong statement of where this conflict, you know, that this conflict between these two empires, what we want to call them, is not over.
You know, we haven't ended. Not at all.
We're not even in a Cold War situation between these two. This is still very hot,
right? And you get lots of notes about Narn overconfidence and Centauri kind of despair, right?
Mm.
Shakar. So willing to play his hand no matter how weak it is, right? And, you know, he's sort of a masterful storyteller. And you get the sense that when he's talking to the League of Non-Aligned Worlds or when he's, you know, he's in council, he knows precisely what to say to get these non-aligned counselors to vote on his side. You know, because the Centauri... When they owned their huge empire, they clearly ran it the way they run everything now, and they're sort of intolerable.
Yeah. And you know, Londo Malari has I get the feeling every time he talks about the great Centauri Empire that he's given up.
Totally,
and this is our only real look into who the Centauri are. So, you know, it makes me wonder if that's the tone of the culture,
right?
That
right,
you know, everything's lost, and we're really on the decline, and why bother?
Right, and you see that also in the behavior of his attaché.
Mm.
Vir Koto, who I come to just love. I mean, I love he has probably, and we'll spend a whole episode, no doubt, talking about this one line of dialogue, right? Mm. He has the best line of dialogue in this entire program.
Yes.
If this were a video podcast, you would know what we just wave to each other, right?
Little audio medium humor there. Yeah.
Yeah. He gets the very best line in the whole show.
Mm-hmm.
I think, but you know, that's for 20 episodes from now. You know, we meet him, you know, and 10 minutes later, he's playing on a Game Boy, you know, when he's supposed to be, you know, conducting the business of state. Right.
Yeah. Well, he's the mirror of Londo.
Right.
And, you know, he's the opposite in so many ways. He's energetic. He's optimistic. We don't get the sense that he's particularly hedonistic like Londo is.
Right.
And, you know, he's got this youthful vim and vigor, where Londo's just like, bah, why bother? So they're an interesting pair to play off each other.
Without question. Yeah. And as, we'll have to continue to watch Londo's despair level. Mm-hmm. Because as he gets more so, you know, Veer gets more and more, he comes more and more into himself. Mm-hmm. Londo seems to get further and further away from himself.
Yeah.
The fact that we open with the Narn testing the Centauri. Mm-hmm. Testing the non-aligned, nations, testing the Earth Alliance, you know, is a sign of the longest story in this program. This conflict is going to bookend everything.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Londo references, you know, the fact that the Centauri can envision their future death, and that he sees Jakar as the agent of his own death. And now here they are both on this station. Their nations are at war. Londo was wrong-footed in gathering. He's wrong-footed mm-hmm. again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how is that going to play out? Well, the fact that the questions being asked and then not answered is what makes this program great.
Right, right. It sort of tidies things up, you know, by the end with, you know, the B plot of the, you know, the raiders and, oh, we found the arms and there's a stand down. But it doesn't, you know, they're not to a, you know, happy, shiny place. By the end of your hour.
No,
not at all.
Not at all.
Yeah. To touch on the dream, the death dream thing, yes. Centauri, I have two thoughts on that. One is that would mess up a culture pretty bad. You know, I would think it would be really distressing to carry for everybody in society to carry that knowledge of how they're going to die.
Right. Yeah,
you know, I guess after a certain amount of generations, you just deal with it. You know, people can adapt to anything. Right. But wow, that is definitely something that that baffles me. And the second is from a writing perspective, that would have been pretty tricky if either of these actors had decided to leave the show, or it had passed or anything like that before the end of the arc. That would have whoops. I guess those dreams aren't that reliable.
Right.
But I just think that would be. I think that would leave a mark on a society.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I don't. We'll have to leave that as a point for further investigation because I don't think they ever go there.
It never comes back up.
I don't think it ever becomes something that is unpacked.
Hmm. We'll put it in the closet here with the gravity rings and just not talk about it again. Yeah.
Mimbari power rings.
Yes.
How I miss them.
Hmm.
Well,
not really.
No, not at all. In fact,
not in the least.
So now. You know, now that we're nearing the end of this episode, I think we have to talk a little bit about dialogue.
Yes, yes. Okay, and our tradition of identifying the most Straczynskiest line
right.
or line reading it, of right, the right. Of the episode. Yep.
Now, I know that we're often going to go to places of long speechifying.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, I think the line in question is actually a pretty dandy one. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the Kosh Sinclair exchange. Mm-hmm. Kosh, they're alone. They're a dying people. We should let them pass. Sinclair, who, the Narn or the Centauri?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's
a good one.
Tells you where. Yeah, that's a good one. And it tells you where the Vorlon see themselves.
Yes.
And where they see the humans.
Yes.
Because, you know, we should let them pass. They are passing people.
Mm. Right.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. The dawn of the third age of mankind, Chris.
Oh, yeah, I suppose.
Yeah. It's the end of the seventh age of Centauri kind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When was the second age of mankind?
Are we in it right now?
Maybe. Topic for a future episode.
Yeah. What was the dawn of the second age of mankind?
Yeah. When we find an episode with not a lot of meat to chew on, we'll revisit that.
We'll pick that up. Maybe we might be talking about that in the next week or two.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
It's very possible.
Well, I went with the straight up speechifying.
Yes.
This one, wow, I won't get through the whole paragraph, but on the issue of galactic peace, I am long past innocence and fast approaching apathy,
right?
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if it's the last breath I take, there will be war. This I swear to you, Commander. This I swear.
This I swear.
Yeah. That's a tough little speech to sit through.
Yeah. Yeah. It is definitely the winner for the Straczynskiest line of the week, though.
Yes.
Without question. Mm-hmm. Well, folks, that's our take on Midnight on the Firing Line, Episode 1, Season 1. In our next episode, we will get a little bit of work done on the Minbari and who they are and where they're coming from. And we will see to Richo you later. Thanks for listening. This is The Name of the Pod. I'm John Cassie.
I'm Chris Tatro. Send us any comments at thenameofthepod@gmail.com. Tell us how great we are, how terrible we are. Leave us reviews. Leave us comments, all those sorts of things. We should be up on iTunes by now or soon or maybe some of those other places.
Indeed.
But, yeah, next week with the Soul Hunter.